Is this tape good? Is this tape good?
This is a conversation with Gloria Richardson. It's Mrs., isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Mrs. Gloria Richardson, Cambridge, Maryland, March 2nd. Mrs. Richardson, do you mind saying something about the local economic situation? I hear the town was moribund a few years ago with 25 business houses closed. But there was an effort to go out and bring in business, and this was quite successful. What's the situation now? Or is this true to what I've been told?
This is quite true. We went, as part of the back history, this was a one-company town, and it was a supposedly benevolent type of paternalism. So it's a packing company. The union came in to organize, and rather than organize, they shut down. So the company, town was not any employment. Of course, they controlled the entire town, politically and economically.
Now, when was this, please?
This is back in the 30s.
Oh, a long time ago.
And sometimes in the 40s, early 40s, I think, they closed down. And, completely closed down. They ran half-mast for some time. In the meantime, during this entire period of time, of course, our other industry was completely shut up, and this was controlled through political maneuvers within the city council. And the whole town thinks this way now. The industry that were to come in here and actually install for it, the growth there has been four or five times the growth in Cambridge.
What way, Ms. Richardson? You said the other industries think the same way.
Not the other industries. The people within within Dorchester County are still thinking, that we don't want outsiders in here. We'd rather not deal with new ideas which industry would bring in, type of thing. So because they still want to control everything that goes on in the town, the people that are involved. Now, recently, in the last 3 years, they have gotten a new industry under the Area Redevelopment Administration program. They set up an industrial complex. This is managed, I'd rather say controlled, by four men that form an industrial development corporation as an offshoot to the Chamber of Commerce. They have brought in plants. They have in small plants. They said they would come in and work 12 months a year, which would begin to solve the problem we have here of seasonal work alone. However, none of these plants to date have worked a full 12 months. They usually work for 4 to 5 months.
What plants are those?
This is Dorset Marine, which now has closed down since the fall. Weston Printing Company, which is a part of American Yearbook, or vice versa. Chung King has just recently opened up this fall. They've been working half-mast since last April. Chung King, Ukraine, Dorset Marine. Airpax Electronics out there, which is now also working on a part-time basis because it has, practically shut down.
I was told this morning that the employment here has been more than, on these new plants, has been more than one half Negro. Is that right?
Well, no, not particularly. They have, for example, I think it's just about one third. They have maybe 50 Negroes out of a possible labor force of 150. And I think it's fairly well distributed so far as Negro versus white. The problem here is that the Negroes are usually confined to a certain type of job. They are usually hired the last, and of course fired first. They've not been able to, reach seniority within these places. These plants are using theory of rotation of labor forces here, which means that they get tied up on the unemployment compensation. They aren't able to achieve seniority or make too much money within the particular factory they're working in. And Chung King is one of these. They'll hire you for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks on a certain process, and they'll lay you off if they say you aren't averaging, and maybe you're off for 2 to 3 to 4 weeks takes 3 weeks to get an unemployment compensation check, and by the time you get your first check, they'll call you back in and put you on another process. In the meantime, the man is still turning out his quarter of some 14,000 cases a day, which means that he's really getting some labor cheaply.
Now, this morning, I'm sitting in a restaurant while waiting for our appointment. I heard two men at the counter, one saying, "I haven't worked in 8 weeks or 10 weeks. And you know why?" The other man said, "Yes, I know why, because you've got a white face." Is there much friction on that basis here?
Yes. Well, I think any time you have these racial disturbances, I think they're more violent because when employment levels are low, everybody's fighting for their own particular self-preservation. And when new jobs come up, of course, the whites feel that they should have them. Usually they do, to the exclusion of the Negro. And this is one of the things that we're concerned about. Right now, the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee is asking for Economic Planning Commission that would produce more jobs for everyone, but also see that there was no discrimination in the hiring. Negroes were trained, you know, if they do not know how to do a job, and the whites said they'd be trained and then compete for the job, you know, on an equal basis. I don't think this is true that they're out of work because they have a white face. This is something that the power structure continually stares up. Most people in Cambridge are out of work this particular time because they're two factories working. I think possibly Western Printing is just about the only one, and in the summer they don't work.
What is the basis of the resentment about the bringing in of the federal food aid? Why that resentment?
The resentment, once again, I feel, I'm pretty sure, is coming from the power structure, the industrial corporation, the county commissioners, and perhaps other people even in the state of Maryland that control employment security and the welfare board. Actually, we ask for food for everyone in Dorchester County. It goes in white because it's a 15% overall unemployment.
Excuse me, who is we there?
The Cambridge Nonviolent Action Committee.
Yes, your organization.
My organization. And, oh dear, I forgot.
You were saying that 15% overall.
Yeah, 15% overall employment question. Now, on the unemployment question. Now, as far as the surplus food program is concerned, I feel that these men, they really aren't concerned whether Negroes and whites are eating. And they're desperately trying to maintain an image of everybody being, I suppose, well-fed and working in Cambridge. I think this is because they don't want to say that the disturbances here in the past year have caused them any harm. But I think they're doing both the Negro community knows, I think they're doing the white community a great deal of harm, because they aren't presenting the true picture, so therefore nobody is motivated to get together and start solving the problem economically.
Has there been any sort of cooperation of a biracial sort here?
Well, no, very little, really. They're predominantly interested in talking, not getting into action. And this is always, in the last 2 years, they've had three different types of biracial commissions. This has been the problem there. They pick out certain things that they want to do, and probably that are the most difficult things to do, and then they get home there. And they also say we have no influence or authority if we can ever get them to the point of trying to push them into action. They go back, you know, and we really can't do anything. So therefore, it's our feeling, as far as my organization is concerned, that it really is necessary for them to be there, that people within the town that have the influence and authority and deal with these things themselves, that's biracial really help, unless they're going to participate in the biracial commission itself.
And people of authority and prestige have not participated, is that the idea?
No, they have not participated. If anything, we have the feeling that behind the scenes they're stalling, because certainly knowing Cambridge and the way it's politically set up, knowing Dorchester County, the way it's politically controlled, if these men wanted certain things to happen, they only have to snap their fingers. It's corrupt politics as usual, but if you can use corrupt politics for a bad end, you certainly can use it for a good end.
What is the standard agricultural production here? Tobacco?
No. There is very little. They have started a soybean industry here last some. I'm not too sure how that's going on. At least they're in the process of doing it. There's very little in the past 3 or 4 years, agricultural-wise, being done. Now, we have canneries here. Industry here is predominantly in the canning end of it, in the seafood business. It's been our position recently that they should use the Rural Areas Development Program to survey and find out how small farms within Dorchester County can be rehabilitated so they could supply some of the produce for the factories here.
But they're dying, are there small farms?
Yes, they are. I think they're just about dead, and there aren't very many large farms in it.
Shall we turn to you for a moment? Well, I understand, this is one of my taxi driver informants, he volunteered this morning, coming over, that your father was on the city council for a number of years, is that right?
My grandfather.
Your grandfather.
50 years, yes.
He said for a long time, 40 or 50 years, I guess he said.
That's right.
When was that?
I'm very bad about things. But the present commissioner has been in, I think, about 15 or 20 years. And my grandfather retired just the time he went into office. So I think that replaced it around 45, perhaps 44.
Do you associate your own interest in public matters, including the Negro movement, with this personal heritage?
No, I don't think so, really, because when I was in school, I was interested in social work. It always disturbed me, you know, whether they were Negroes or whites, the problems that were involved. However, within Dorchester County, because of the way it's made up, this problem has become predominantly Negro at the time. But I still hope that there will be some point in which underprivileged people can get together and work toward a solution together, regardless of color. And if the surplus food here is indicative of a tiny step in that direction, because we have had whites anonymously calling saying, well, you know, we need food too, and we approve this program. And I asked them, you know, why don't you push from your side? And they said, well, you know, I'm afraid that my husband is the only one working, might lose his job, my daughter's the only one working, and she might lose her job because apparently, you know, the people in the driver's seat don't want it.
For the reasons you earlier
gave. Reasons I earlier mentioned. And you see, if you get economically stable white and Negro populace, and they can't control them politically, they can't pay for their votes, you know, they begin to think and stand on their own bottom, and they act more or less independently.
Where did you go to school, Ms. Richardson?
At Howard University.
Yes, I was. And to the local high school before that here?
Yes,
or else?
Yes, I did.
And you majored in social work at Howard?
Sociology.
Sociology, and?
I got married, actually, before I got into, I was getting ready to get my master's in social psychiatry, really.
Yes.
And I got married, and I've never gotten back to this.
And then you moved back here again?
That's right. Mm-hmm. I worked for several years in the government before I came back here. And it was there that I learned, regardless of a college education, you know, or any degree of intelligence, that at that particular time, you know, you couldn't make the same progress within your job, moving from grade level to grade level, as someone that was white.
This Indian government work.
That's right, which really meant that the college education that you had gotten did not mean too much as far as achievement was concerned.
There's undoubtedly a question that's been working all along the line.
Yes, I think all over the United States, you know, according to the census, a Negro college graduate makes 49% less than a white college graduate with the same background, the same ability, the same training. And this is extremely unfortunate because most of the Negroes have had to struggle to put their children through school, and the myth that if they're educated, you know, they can get decent well-paying jobs and in turn educate their families. And this simply is not true. We're not working out. And that, you know, the Negro is restricted to certain types of fields, lawyers, doctors, the teaching profession. There's quite a number of students that prefer to do other things, but they realize opportunity isn't open to them now. And I think this kills ambition at an early age.
Way back in the school, this sense of...
Yes, this sense
a
of...
A low horizon for...
That's right.
Occupation.
And sometimes I think that's one of the causes for early dropouts. And then if you cannot go to college in a community like Cambridge, then they know that no matter how intelligent or how brilliant a school record they have, that they're going to come out and skin tomatoes and shuck oysters.
Yeah.
And that's it. Now, a white student here at the same level may come out and work in a tomato house or a seasoned plant for a year, perhaps, and then they, you know, found something else or two. They're on their way up the ladder, something that interests them more.
Has there been any change, however slow in that respect, around here?
No.
Still?
They're still
frozen.
The same, still, that's right, still the same thing.
Something else that's not associated with that, but has some bearing on it. Do you notice in a town like Cambridge a split between the Negro middle class and the Negro lower class or laboring class? How much is the split?
I think it's a very wide split. And I found this really throughout, in all the places I have been, in the States, because although you may find one or two people in the middle class that will get out of the fight, but I think as far as the Negro is concerned, that the middle class Negro has usually come from a lower level and achieved this, and they have used a white image on what success is. And once they begin to become like this image in their minds, and they're afraid to do anything that would disturb it, and they ignore, I think this is psychological, they ignore the fact that there are many, many people, many, many Negroes, who have, you know, little or nothing, and that these Negroes need these people to articulate for them, and to also give them moral courage to go ahead and fight. For example, in Cambridge, there are a lot of more people that we could get involved here, out in the open instead of behind the scenes, if some of the business people or professional people would come out in the street with them.
But you don't find many who will.
No, well, in Cambridge there isn't anyone really.
That seems to vary from one part of the country to another, a little bit anyway, as far as I can make out.
Well, this is possible. I know in Albany, several years ago, when that grew up, everybody was involved there.
In Albany, Georgia.
Yes. And this is a very beautiful thing to see. You know, everybody was relating to each other because they had the same problem. Here in Cambridge and a lot of other places, we find all too often the middle class Negro will use the same rationale that the white power structure is using, and you know, turning it against us too. You know, well, they don't know how to act. They don't have enough education. You know, they really aren't. They live lazy, and this type of thing. And they really won't go back and think why these people are like that, and that it's really a vicious circle. You know, you have to be able to get into decent schools in order to be properly educated. And you have to have, be able to get jobs without discrimination in order to make the money to have the decent housing, and this goes round and round. But they, you know, refuse to see this thing and to agree with usually the biracial commission.
That is, if I hear you, understand you are right, the successful Negro detaches himself from the lower class Negro.
This is true.
Feels that this lower class Negro is not capable of entering the world of opportunity and success.
That's right, and the middle class Negro is not secure himself within the realms of his own success to be able to associate or talk or relate to a lower income Negro without feeling, oh, well, this is going to embarrass me, you know.
A threat to him in one way or another.
Yes, a threat to him, you know. Somebody, you know, the white man might look at me and say, well, maybe he's like that too, you know. It really doesn't make any difference. Everybody can relieve him by acting like that.
Let me read a quotation to you from Du Bois, written long ago, for a comment I made. No Negro who has given serious thought to this situation of his people in America has failed at some time in life to find himself at a crossroads. It's the same thing, you see, we're getting at.
Yes, yes.
Has failed to ask himself at the same time, what, after all, am I? Am I an American or am I a Negro? Can I be both? Or is it my duty to cease to be a Negro as soon as possible and become an American? This leads on in other parts of Du Bois' writing and the writing of other people and conversation to a sense of a real split in the psyche sometimes, you know, this situation.
Yes, there is this.
Can you be a Negro? Can one be a Negro and also enter the white society, or is one losing identity in this process?
I happened to think about this last week. No, I personally would prefer being a Negro American, you know, just like any other a racial group that has come into America. I think I feel I would not be fighting like this if I didn't feel that I was an American. But I also want to be identified as a Negro. And I think that with the great racial complexity in America, that this can be done. That you can keep your identity as a Negro and still be an American. But I certainly don't think because you know, are Negro American that you should not have all the facilities available to you, you know, that America has to offer. I think we will get to the point, we aren't now, I think we will get to the point where perhaps in our minds we'll think of ourselves, you know, as Americans, but we will still be Negroes. There will not be a split, but this is the same thing, you know, Irish and
yes.
Germans and various other people.
Jews most acutely feel it. I mean, I've heard Jews talking about
yes.
this very question and make a parallel with the Negro situation.
That's right.
I know some Negroes, some I've talked with lately, who would say, I feel the mystical association with Africa, with race,
yeah,
as opposed to white middle class American values. And I feel if we are absorbed culturally or in terms of blood, something dies in me.
Yes, I think this is true. I think this is the feeling. And I think that because of the background we've had, having come from Africa, that we would be able to contribute far more to America as part of our culture we could retain. It certainly wouldn't be in conflict with America. I think we'd add to it.
You wouldn't feel your identity threatened then by this movement toward an integrated society in which such values would be absorbed and become a contribution to American life and not set off from American life.
That's true.
You wouldn't feel your identity threatened, your personality threatened.
No.
Of course, some do.
They do. No, because I think this is because so few Negroes have really found out what they themselves are.
As you would argue that way, yes.
Yes, and I think that as the movement grows and as people begin to become more able to move about freely in society, they'll be able to say, yes, I am a Negro, I know from where I came, I am an American, I can contribute to society, you know, American society, without feeling threatened because they're supposed to be integrated into that society.
Have the black Muslims come into this part of the
Well, we have Muslims here, yes. They have not been active, except within their own group, with any program here. I admire the Muslims for quite a few things. There's some things I also disagree with them about. I think they've done a very fine job in discipline within their movement, particularly since they work with low-income Negroes and they've begun to change their values. So far as how they, you know, send them money and they've given them pride in themselves. However, I can't go along with a separate state. I have really, you know, I don't think it's a separate state. I think they've done quite, I think they articulate the problem in Negro very well. It's probably quite radical articulation, but I think this particular time we need to, because the low-income groups know what their problems are, and they suffer every day because of them. We need to know that somebody's up there to stand up and tell, you know, all these other people what they think.
This, as related to the previous question, the one raised by you boys, is a tricky one, isn't it?
Yes,
the Muslim says racial pride means withdrawal, refusal to enter that society.
Yes, well, I don't agree with that, because I think if you have the racial pride and you found out, you know, what you really are in terms of Negro, you've accepted it, then you would have no fear. You would not have to withdraw. You would go into that society and stand on your own 2 feet. I think this is what you're going to have to do. If you withdraw, you're going to eventually be right back where you are. I'm a separate personality, an identity, and possibly I can't compete, you know, in this type of thing.
There's a hatred and exclusiveness then set in.
That's right, and this always is destructive.
On the question of the effects of segregation, we know a great many of the destructive effects.
Mm.
Sometimes we encounter the notions of what have been, in a kind of backhand way, constructive effects for the Negro himself. Does that thought ever cross your mind?
No, only in one small instance, and this is in regards to the South, where they have had to run their own businesses and find some insurance companies. I think these are the people that, when the bars or the walls are finally torn down, we will perhaps to function much better in the white society at those levels than perhaps we would on the borderline states who have had no experience in regards to competition. But that's just about the only thing, and perhaps I haven't thought, if you think I should, about it, that I can think of as constructive, because anything that's based on the inferiority of one personality or race against another is always bad for us.
Undoubtedly, we have vast destructive effects. This is a quotation from Mr. Farmer, from James L. Farmer. Discrimination increased my determination to do something about inferiority feelings. I felt handicapped, but never doubted my own abilities. And this sort of quotation appears over and over again, apparently always among, you might say, leader types.
Yes, I think this is something constructive coming out of it, not
reaction to the challenge.
Yes. I think this is what, rather than you can say the segregation has had constructive aspects, I think this is where something constructive has come out of the thing. You know?
Some human force has been stimulated that might otherwise
right.
have escaped stimulation.
That's right.
For instance, do you associate such a notion with the eminence of Southern Negro leaders in recent years?
Yes, I think this is certainly true, in particular with the younger people, and they're just not willing to accept these things any longer. I know years ago we weren't willing to accept it. We really had not thought of anything to do about it. I don't think any solution had begun to arise in this generation until the sit-ins began in 1956. We began to see that there was a way without violence, although certainly nonviolence seems to sparkle. Direction of violence. And it's the first time that quite a few of us saw any type of vehicle through which we could fight segregation.
But this new, quote, new Negro, how do you account for this emergence at that particular time?
I think it's been growing. For quite some time, this is going back to when I was in school, and there was always quite a bit of resentment. And then you went through the war years, and they made a lot more money. People were able to send more of the Negro children to school, to college, and becoming educated, coming in contact with a variety of ideas. Quite a few of them, if their parents had been overseas, they'd come back. And I think for 10 or 15 years since the war, this has been slowly accumulating until the forces there would have to eventually erupt. And I think with the 54 decision, where everybody thought in a couple of years they were going to be all right, and it just has not happened.
May I interrupt just a second now to be sure we're doing... Sorry.
And of course, it has not happened. It's been practically 10 years since the 54 decision. I think this was the kickoff point where your resentment and wondering what we could do about it finally began to take focus. Some of these students now, of course, were in high school then. When they went in the car, you know, still no different. You know, but something else had to be done. And they fortunately found it.
I've asked this question of quite a few people as to why this particular time. Sometimes the person I'm talking with will say it could have happened any time, say in 32, 33, 34. Now such people resist the idea that there's been a process of education and enlargement of leadership. You see, what there's an emotional block to that notion that it could have happened any time.
No, I don't think this is true, that it could have happened at any time. It could have happened just about when it did. In the 30s, in the first place, everybody in America was too concerned on getting something to eat, basically. And so you really didn't have chance, you know, to have time to think about finding things. You got a piece of bread. Very good. I think it's a process, you know?
It's a process.
And it's been coming along. I think perhaps the 30s and the labor unions might have shown them some of the ways in which we can do this, you know, in their subconscious mind. And it has evolved. They've used some of the tactics of the nonviolent movement. But no, I don't think it could have happened at any time. I think if it happened then, it would have been in the form of riot. I mean, actually.
Not organized.
Not organized.
Blind violence.
That's right.
The reason I pursue this topic, the people who resist the idea of a process tend to feel, when this is explored a little bit, that the mere acceptance of the idea of process in the past implies process in the future.
True too.
And they resist that idea, so as to put it in the extreme form, a young student discussing this question said, a very, very bright student. He said, I know historical process is a thing in time. And that we are in the moment of historical process, which means that tomorrow morning the world will not be different. And suddenly he said, but I can't bring myself to say it. You see what I'm getting at?
Yes,
he splits, or he doesn't argue it out and put the process and the question of what freedom now mean together. He says, suddenly he says, but I can't bring myself to say it.
Yes, I think they're going to have to bring themselves to say it. Now, this, I think probably the block here is because always when you go into negotiating sessions, they say, you know, well, it takes time. This is a different thing from realizing it's a historical process, because you're going to be fighting every step of the way instead of just sitting down waiting, you know, quietly for 6, 7, 8 months, a year or two for something to suddenly happen. You're working. And certainly moving along, although maybe day by day you can't see it. It may take 2 or 3 months to see the kind of progress you're making.
As history is not a Christmas tree, in other words.
No.
But that's a very important emotional element in the whole movement, and as far as I can make out, at least it is. And the response of people, this person is a contrast with that person, and with that person, to the slogan, freedom now. What that means,
well,
is differently interpreted, you
yes,
see.
Yes, it is. And of course, it's necessary for the movement to have slogans, simple slogans, that people can understand. But I think, for example, in Cambridge now, in the protest movement here, people are beginning to realize that it's going to be much longer process than just saying freedom now and going into a restaurant and coming back out again. I think they accept it, but they aren't going to accept that you sit down, you know, and just suddenly wait for something to happen. You fight and pressure and push as long as you can to get these things. That was the trouble before. When I was in school 20 years ago, you know, they've begun to put Negroes in this position and that position, high government, you know, and everything is going to be all right because these people were proven the Negro could do it. And now 20 years later, you know, they don't have any more. Large number of Negroes are not progressing up steps, and this is idea. But that gives people a disillusion about that too. And if they started pushing 10 years ago instead of being willing to say, oh, this is great, you know, they're playing the Negro here and there, we'd be further along today. We would have quickened the historical process.
In other words, there's no real opposition or paradox involved here. These are just aspects of a process.
That's right. I think they, yeah.
I came across an idea in Eric Lincoln. In the American Negro groups of highest and lowest status, hardly anyone wants to be a Negro. Upper class Negroes seek to identify with whites. Lower class Negroes prefer to identify themselves with any group except the white in order to escape the danger of being Negro.
No, I think it's true of the middle class Negro. I don't think it's true. I think it's a myth as far as the lower class Negro is concerned. Because I find that they really have no fear, even in regards to jobs, because the person is white. The only fear, their fear comes from the fact that because the person is white, you'll get the better advantage without their ever being able to compete for it. I think the other thing is a middle class idea. I don't want to identify, you know, with the white community, just to be identifying with it. I do not want to be identified with it. I would rather be able to be me, a Negro, and able to be accepted as a Negro, as an American, and for what I can do myself, what my personality, however that can fit in. And rather than simply because I have a certain type of house and a certain type of car, and buy a certain brand of whiskey, and this type of thing. Because you take the car away, the house away, and the money away, you're right back where you started out. You don't have any more stable basis than that.
Another general notion that one encounters now and then among sociologists, Lloyd Warner, for one, whom I went to graduate school 1,000 years ago. Well, he has written that the American Negro, culturally, is more like the white old American than he is like anything else.
This is possibly true.
The old New England or the old Southerner?
Yes, from what I have read, this is possibly true, yes.
Have you read Faulkner's Intruder in the Dust?
A long time ago, I think. I'm not sure. I have read Faulkner, but I can't remember.
Yes, that particular question that Lord Warner raises may or may not be what Faulkner intended when he says homogeneity in the Southern white and the Southern Negro, as opposed to another kind of world unspecified. It's something that may be in common.
I think this is possibly true because here in Cambridge, you know, you have the whites on one side and Negroes on the other, and they both have the same characteristics. They're equally stubborn, you know, they're equally as proud of the town, you know, even with the division there. So you have them both fighting on both sides with some of the same qualities and characteristics that you have to face and fight in the opposition. And there are times, as someone said the other day, where you just wonder if you're just going to get a stalemate where you have to culturally.
You know Miss Lucy Thornton, of course, at Howard.
At Howard, yes.
She said to me at the same lunch where I met you, she said she had optimism about the solution of the race question in the South. She said she felt that somewhere along the way the fact of a common history, a common cultural experience, though on different sides of the experience, meant some human recognition. Said you thought you might have a basis to work with there after all the rough stuff.
No, this is only, I think, if you get some sort of a tax, for example, in America from without being certified. I don't think within the framework of the civil rights fight right now you can get it. There's certainly in various areas and here, we're working to find a common basis.
Well, I think she wasn't saying that you have it now. As
I know that she was looking for
afterwards,
but it's going to be a long time. Probably not even in my child's generation. Probably part of the process too, but it's got to be after. This is only can happen after this desperate fight we're putting up now.
Mr. Evers, Mr. Charles Evers, said to me a few weeks ago, I have some real hope for Mississippi, because these people, even the tough segregationists, that many of them are reared in an old-fashioned tradition of respecting courage. And he said, if you stand up to him, he respects that. He recognizes there's something to admire. And second, he said, once a line has been crossed, he's probably going to play fair, probably tell you the truth.
I think in places like Mississippi, this is probably true because the resistance there is so great, you know, and they have made such a violent attack on any type of civil rights endeavor. And I think when you get people to that stage, you know, once a confrontation, I think it's going to have to be a confrontation there, and once that has happened on a massive scale, then people have a tendency, you know, to see how they have acted or what they've done wrong. I think this is possibly one of the things. Salisbury is 30 miles from here, and they claim that Salisbury is completely the people in Cambridge because they lynched a man there. But it's my feeling because they lynched a man there 20-some years ago, they have had a chance to look back on this act as something disgraceful, and they don't want to go through that type of thing again. They've made them, you know, stop and think. Here in Cambridge, where race relations were always peaceful and good because they had not lynched anybody, they haven't had that type of violence, inside violence, to bring them to their senses.
You know, Miss Thornton went on to say that the big northern cities frightened her more because of the anonymity of the relation.
I think this is true, and then I think another thing about the northern cities, they've had very little organization as far as the framework of the movement as against the South in the North. And yet you have thousands of people in these ghettos there that have felt the same type of deprivation that they had in the South. The exception in the North, they went to the North because they thought everything would be so much greater. So now they're disillusioned. You know, this is as against us. We didn't go anyplace and suddenly think the world was going to open up. And I think that there probably will be, you will get more more race riots in these northern type of towns than you would down in this type, except unless of course an issue were attacked. Because I think there's more violence within the people right now. They're more prone to violence. And they have not, you cannot reach them to get, you know, any type of nonviolent theory imposed on their mind.
On that point, may I read a quotation to you from Dr. Kenneth Clark on the matter of violence and Dr. King's theory? On the surface, King's philosophy appears to reflect health and stability, while black nationalism betrays pathology and instability. A deeper analysis, however, might reveal that there is also an unrealistic, if not indeed pathological, basis in King's doctrine. The natural reaction to injustice is bitterness and resentment. The forms which such bitterness take need not be overtly violent, but the corrosion of the spirit seen inevitable. It would seem, therefore, that any demand that the victim of oppression love those who oppress him puts an additional and intolerable psychological burden upon him.
I agree with that. I don't see, you know, this reason of loving your enemy, because it's unnatural. I don't think that hate should be a thing that you would continue simply because the person is white, you know. But I think you should be able to control it. But I don't think you should have to love your enemy. And a great many people that you have to work with at the grassroots level simply refuse to understand. I don't understand it myself because, you know, when I go downtown or to sit in a restaurant or we're having demonstrations, I don't love those people. Now, certainly, I have never felt, I can't get to the point where I hate them either. But I don't love them. You know, they're just there, they're acting badly, and they're creating a danger.
As you don't follow Dr. King's philosophy on this point.
No. I think possibly Dr. King has used this, and he possibly believes it. I think it's necessary in the beginning of the movement to get to the point where you control the people that are demonstrating from starting the violence.
Let me give you what one person said to me in answer to this quotation. He said, "This is true of the natural man to resent it," and not said, "but the Christian is not a natural man; he is a redeemed man."
Well, then I think.
And the Christian ethic is that of a redeemed man. You see what I mean?
Yes. Well, this certainly, as far as theory, but then this is the trouble with a lot of theories: they aren't very practical, and you have to put them into effect. And I think to send people out when they know what they're up against, and they know what has happened to them because of segregation, they know they've suffered, and to ask them, you know, God, you love that man, is just, as you said a few minutes ago, is adding an additional psychological burden on them. And I don't think being Christian have anything to do with it, because actually, even as a Christian, you know, everybody doesn't go around loving everybody else regardless of color.
Professing Christians and real Christians are very different things, though, aren't they?
Well, yes, and you only occasionally come across real Christians.
But I suppose Dr. King is talking about the real Christian as opposed to the professing Christian.
I suppose he is, but there again, that's where I think he's in trouble, because they are more, you know, professed Christians than they are real ones. Even within the framework of Christianity, they are still striving for the, you know, the perfect goal. They have never attained it.
It's never been attained, no. What about the Gandhian philosophy? Do you reject that?
No, I don't reject the Gandhian philosophy of nonviolence, and I certainly also think that it's got to be realized that there comes a point when nonviolence is at an end, and the next step would be what we are now opposed to, is violence. You know, when you have the nonviolence, you've got mass movements, and you've gotten nowhere, and you're constantly being attacked. I think tactically, mass nonviolence, or massive nonviolence, when you can organize it, is a very tremendous thing. But, and I think it can work. But, I think that's why tactically, Gandhi philosophy, I think it's the best basis for us to use now.
But you regard it as a tactical device rather than as a philosophy. Is that the distinction?
I think I admire it as a philosophy. And right now I'm using it as a tactical device. Yes. Because violence is not going to solve anything. When you get completely violent situations, everything just breaks down. Nobody wants to try and solve the problem. They just want to get out there in the streets and fight. And you have so many women and children involved. And the situation in America today with the race problem, you know, the flare up all across the country, it would be a type of civil war situation. And that would really, you know, set us back.
Let me paraphrase to you something from my interview with Mr. Evers on this point. On the tapes I have from him, from Jackson on the 12th of February, he said several things, and I've recently played the tapes back to be sure of this. He said, violence never solved anything, as you said. Birmingham, with a disaster, has broken down the possibility of communication for a long time to come. And developed that line of thought. Then, 5 days later, he made a speech in Nashville at the NAACP Freedom Dinner. I was not there, but I had the newspaper reports on it. He then advocated non-selective reprisal. Oh, I hadn't said, reporters write this down. Now, I don't know what happened between these two in 5 days there, but at least if someone is, if a Negro is killed in Mississippi, we will kill a white man. If a church with children is bombed, we will bomb a white church with children. It's a non-selective reprisal. Not selecting just a man who belongs to a culpable group, you see, in the sense of a segregationist.
No, but I can't see that in the context of the civil rights movement now. Now, as far as I'm concerned, in Cambridge, our demonstrators were nonviolent. You know, we saw that. But always, the thing was, when we got back within the Negro community, and we had mobs of whites getting to break in, I said, you know, you go back into your homes and defend your homes and your person and your children. And but that isn't reprisal.
That's not reprisal.
No, that's self-defense. Now, if someone gets killed in the course of that, well, then that's, you know, a natural thing. I don't believe in non-selective reprisal. I don't believe in selective reprisal, not when it comes to killing or bombing. I think that you can find a different kind of reprisal within the context of nonviolence.
Now, what? How would you argue that, Ms. Richardson? How would you justify that position? This is a terribly important question, isn't it?
Because as a human being, I may be ever so angry, but I can't go out, I can't be going out and killing another child because my child has been killed. Just any other child, any other person. I can't be bombing a church because the people that you get may have had nothing to do. They may not even have thought like the people that did it to you. And you're taking a chance of involving, you know, innocent people just because of this reprisal type of thing.
As this is a human and ethical refusal on your part to do
that. Yes.
There's also, I gather, a tactical element, too, in your refusal to do it.
No, I think in this particular instance, it's more ethical.
Just ethical.
It's ethical and tactical. And
I must say,
I think there are other things that you can do.
Such as?
Well, for example, the case in Birmingham, I think people should have gone immediately out in the streets and demonstrated nonviolently, you know, and carried the movement on. You know, they'd have to make up their mind once and for all whether they were going in for home-scale violence as far as the white community is concerned, or whether they were going to settle down and have good sense and try and solve the solutions, because I'm not too sure. I think it was rather bad not to do anything about that, particularly since they couldn't get federal troops in there. Always in this type of nonviolent fight, you cannot stop nonviolent demonstrations because violence is being used against you for the next time it's even worse. These people think it's because they have frightened you. And they know you really aren't attacking them. You know, you're permitting yourself to be attacked. And just psychologically, they'll be worse the next time they think that you're running.
You mean if you refuse to demonstrate immediately afterward, they will assume that they have frightened you?
That's right.
So the technique then is to demonstrate again and again, accept the punishment.
That's
is that
right.
It? To affirm the point.
That's right. And if they had demonstrated, you know, actually in protest of the bombing, or demonstrated when they did nothing about it, you know, when they let the guards loose, then they would have had federal troops in there, and it's quite possible they may have had a few more things solved than they have at the present time.
Now, there are some people in Mississippi, younger people, some Negroes and some whites,
yes,
who both us who say this. Now, these are younger ones. There may be older ones, too, say it. These young ones have said it to me. They regretted that the Neo riot in Jackson, at Jackson College, was headed off partly by the pacifying efforts of Mr. Evers, but they wanted a tactical crisis, even run wild riot, troops, Nationalized Guard, then something else. As with two attitudes in Mississippi, they're quite in conflict. One wants the violence, the kind of a violent situation to develop, so you have to have federal troops.
I think this is true. I don't think it's wanting violence. I think once, or for instance, in the situation in Jackson, the stoplight, that once it's been started against you, that you have to come out and demonstrate against you, because unfortunately, nobody goes into Mississippi or even into Cambridge unless the federal government will not interfere unless they are pushed to their back against the wall. It's an unfortunate thing. And most of the people, I think, within the movement, young and old, realize this. I mean, this is another one of the sacrifices they're going to have to court violence, as long as it doesn't come from us.
Well, my friends...
By confrontation.
Yes. My friends were expecting Negro violence, you see, which would real street
fight.
Oh,
I see what you mean.
Real street fight, real bloodshed. Or even, as one said, running wild through the white residential section.
Yeah, this I don't get.
To get troops in.
Yes, but actually, you see, in these areas, you really don't have to run wild. You just go down there and demonstrate in the residential section. And that would start, I don't think, but I think the younger people, and I sympathize with this, and I'm afraid that eventually they may be right, and I think the next year, or even the next 7 or 8 months, are going to tell the tale. Because you see, you get this thing, this myth of poor whites always attacking, but you see, the well-to-do citizens are sitting there letting them attack, and very happy that they are, and the conflict, or the violence never takes place in their sections. They can sit in their comfortable homes, and have dinner and know that everything on the other side of town is being taken care of.
In that connection, let me quote or paraphrase
maybe
from James.
I'm not being entirely honest either.
Beg pardon?
I was thinking maybe I wasn't being entirely honest either, because I think, too, that now the movement has gotten to a point where it has to go on 2 feet, so to speak. And I think that's a good thing because, for example, here in Cambridge, we had 400 to 500 people demonstrating. But there were so many more that weren't committed to nonviolence, 1,500 or 1,600 people that were lying, Negroes that were lying in the streets, ready to defend us. We had at that particular time last summer the job on our hands of preventing these people from going out and doing anything. But then you see...
Excuse me, you mean preventing people who might be violent, become violent,
right,
from going out?
Yes, involved in demonstrations and that. And so far we've been able to do it. But now, in the case of Princess Anne, this was just brought home to me when I went down to demonstrate last Saturday and Wednesday. Well, Saturday a week ago and Wednesday, you see, the same state police we had in here that put the dogs on the children, the fire hoses, were completely brutal for no reason at all, would not have run loose in Cambridge like that because they were 1,500 adults and were torn up the town.
Now, I understand that you attempted at Princess Anne to get the students off the street back on the campus, is that right?
That was not me, that was a student meeting. I attempted to keep them on there.
Beg pardon?
No, that was the student leaders at that time. I attempted to keep them on there. The first Saturday.
Keep them in.
Yeah, the first Saturday, I kept them on there. I think this is the case that because that was that thing grew up so large, the student leaders weren't prepared for it. We weren't quite sure the school administration would do. And the students themselves wanted to stay out. It was my opinion that they wanted to still stay out and face this, they should be allowed to do it. because they realized by then, the first Saturday I went down there, what they were in for, because they took the dogs off the leashes that day and turned them loose in the crowd. Now, on Wednesday, when the whole thing broke loose, they were still willing to do this. And I didn't ever lose my feeling. And it was a student leader's feeling on Wednesday, too, that they should not stop. They should not be backed back into the campus because of the violence. And of course, they kept going back and grouping and going back again. And in the end, of course, they decided they could go up for a mass march, sing songs, and have a prayer session, and return to the campus for the next day. And of course, this is when they got into violence.
I think I read this in the Maryland, in a Maryland paper, the Cambridge paper, the Banner, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
That you had struggled to get the students off the street and back onto the campus. To... Did you see that story?
No, I didn't. What actually happened, you see, somebody, they were there from Cambridge, and thought that the rest of the reporters do not have this idea. There was a time when they started getting to the point where they wanted to pick up rocks and throw at the dogs, you know.
Yes.
And at that particular time, because so many 57 students had been hurt one way or the other.
Yes.
We called them back to the campus, and I did take the megaphone and say, oh, Merlin, take them back to the campus. We got them back. But to take them back and talk to them and explain to them in terms of what our experience had been, what was going on in the streets, and to take them back then.
Excuse me. This is the end of tape one of a conversation with Mrs. Gloria Richardson. See tape 2.